You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of April 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Kenya strikes back, bombing what Nairobi claims are Al-Shabaab training camps and what Al-Shabaab claim is uninhabited farmland. Jane Kinnamont and Robert Fox will be joining me to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including the latest from Yemen as the conflict there draws in more regional powers and keeps out aid organisations. President Barack Obama's attempt to sell his Iran deal. Will he have to work harder with American and Israeli naysayers than Iranian ones? The US Army's preparations to admit female combat soldiers to special forces units. Are the recruits and the units ready for each other? And the CIA's unfond farewell to its most famous fictional operative. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are indeed Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow and Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and Robert Fox, Defence Editor at the Evening Standard here in London. Welcome both back to Midori House. We will start with Kenya, which has today delivered what is at least the very first instalment of its revenge for last week's attack by Al-Shabaab on the campus of Garissa University. Kenyan's Air Force struck and, by their account, destroyed two Al-Shabaab camps inside Somalia. Al-Shabaab denied the reports, claiming that the airstrikes succeeded only in ploughing up farmland. Robert, I'll start with you. From a purely military strategic point of view, the massacre at the Garissa campus was 4 days ago. Is there any chance that even if the Kenyan Air Force have hit what they aimed at, there was anybody still in any of those training camps waiting around to be bombed?
Gosh, how do I know? But I do follow you. I think it has almost little relevance as far as the agenda is concerned. And the problem with this, as you know, is how many of these Shabab and how much was the plot generated by Kenyan Shabab and not Somali Al-Shabaab. And the other thing is, are they right in assuming that by defeating Al-Shabaab, pushing them back from the big towns to the north in Somalia, that they're carrying out these attacks? I think that is not a given. And there is one other thing which the Kenyans have not satisfied, and I think it's a huge problem, why the response was so very, very slow. Once the attack started, the bulk of the forces, security forces, didn't arrive for 8 hours.
It is that is one of many peculiar and extraordinary aspects of this. But Jane, again, looking at Kenya's response, I mean, it was obvious as soon as the scale of what had happened at Garissa became apparent that Kenya would be obliged to react militarily. So if we knew that Kenya were going to do this, it's a fair bet that Al-Shabaab knew that Kenya were going to do this. Was provoking a larger Kenyan intervention perhaps the point of the attack?
It's quite possible. I mean, there's two reasons for Kenya to retaliate in this way. One is to attempt to establish deterrence, but we just don't know if Al-Shabaab are deterrable. The other reason, of course, is to be seen to react, to have some kind of revenge and to be seen to be doing something. Kenya's clearly divided about this. You've had the leader of the opposition saying what we should be doing is pulling our forces out of Somalia.
Indeed so. And it was, of course, on his watch as Prime Minister that Kenyan troops went in there in the first place. That would seem certainly politically unfeasible to react to something like this by withdrawing your troops. But Robert, as a genuine or a general principle, it's 20 years, I guess, or getting on for 20 years since NATO's airstrikes against Bosnian Serb irregulars in Bosnia. And we do see this repeated pattern of irregular non-state militias waging war on the ground, to which the only response anybody seems to be able to come up with is trying to, you know, blow up converted Toyotas and motorcycles using incredibly expensive 21st century aircraft.
Yeah, as we're seeing against Daesh, ISIL in Syria and Iraq. I'm delving into your predicate to this, and I think it is profound. I think it is absolutely clear that sophisticated advanced forces like the Kenyan army, but also their allies, do not want to get involved with on the ground with these people. And that's why it's an excuse. It was a very thin excuse when the allies got involved in Libya. It proved disastrous because they couldn't manage the second and third line strategic consequences from that. It's a very cheap option and it comes up short. And that's what we're watching both in Iraq, Syria, and to an extent in Somalia now.
Well, and also in the dateline of our next story, across the Gulf of Aden, in a conflict which is beginning to make Somalia's interminable umpty way all in seem relatively straightforward. In Yemen, we have a campaign of airstrikes by Saudi Arabia and a posse of their allies, which appears to have done little to halt the advance of Houthi rebels from the north of the country. The country's civilians now face shortages of water, food and electricity, as well as the air raids. Though Riyadh has given permission for the Red Cross to send aid, the Red Cross reports surprising difficulty finding charter companies willing to fly there. Jane, I guess expanding on what Robert was just saying, do we get the sense now that the air campaign is actually only continuing because it would be embarrassing for Riyadh to admit that it hasn't actually worked?
It's not clear what the Saudis' game plan is for this. I mean, they have a scenario that they would like to achieve. They would like, obviously, to weaken the Houthis. They would like to break the alliance between the Houthis and the former Yemeni president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, because he brings quite a lot of fighters to the Houthis' cause. And they would like to bring those people back to the negotiating table and have a political way out. But with the Houthis on bended knees saying, you've bombed us, we realise that we overdid things, now we're sorry. The Houthis currently showed no inclination to do that. And it's not at all clear what plan B is for Saudi Arabia and its allies.
Robert, is it even clear what plan A is?
No, because exactly. I mean, very good point. Because, yes, we've seen Saudi forces bombing refugee camps. We now hear that President al-Sisi is sending four Egyptian warships to the Red Sea. What are they going to do? Because I think it's Jane and you were saying, we're facing a disintegrating society here. That, you know, in the best of times, in the most peaceable of times, which haven't been there for a hell of a long time, I admit, that, you know, there's water shortage. It's a terrible situation and it's a large population. What is worrying is the evident aggression of Saudi policy, particularly since the arrival of the new king.
Well, on that subject, the thought that occurs to me is one difference between this and certainly Western-led air campaigns in Bosnia, Kosovo and Iraq is that there is almost no independent media scrutiny of what is going on the ground. How careful do you think the Saudi Air Force are being about what they're bombing?
It's my fault. I haven't really looked up the weaponry, what they're using. I mean, are they using JDAM satellite-guided weaponry, which I suspect they are, laser-designated? Even so, that doesn't rule out anything. To do air-only campaigns is incredibly dangerous. To actually make them work with the precision you're implying, Andrew, you actually need ground controllers. You need forward aircraft controllers if you want to get really into the forward line of troops, absolutely down to the forces. And I think that it must be a bit of a bloodbath going on there. And I think this is just a lot more trouble being stirred up as we speak.
Jane, the UN, not unreasonably, or you at UNICEF specifically, says that Yemen is on the verge of humanitarian disaster. Is there anything anyone can actually do about that, at least while the situation is the situation?
There will be attempts, of course, to get aid in. The problem is Yemen was on the verge of a humanitarian disaster before the airstrikes started. So this is compounding the problem. UNICEF say that a million children cannot go to school. Something like two-thirds of the population do not have access to clean drinking water. So the situation is horrendous. But for aid agencies alone, to fix the problem just isn't realistic. It really will depend on the airstrikes stopping, there being some kind of ceasefire and moves potentially towards some kind of political solution.
But that humanitarian aspect is surely presumably magnified by the geography of this. With a case like we were discussing, Bosnia and Kosovo, those who could leave Bosnia or Kosovo had the option of fleeing to a number of relatively well-off, secure, prosperous European nations, whereas your options from Yemen are Saudi Arabia, Oman, or as we are actually, with wretched irony, seeing some refugees doing, going by boat to Somalia. And if you're running away to Somalia seeking shelter, that says a lot about the state your own country's in. Robert, one interesting point was that the Chinese Navy, for the first time, is evacuating foreign nationals from Aden along with its own. Is this just expedience, or is China actually sensing a certain opportunity for a sort of soft power initiative, if you will?
China knows it has to be an increasingly big player in the Gulf because of the way America is stepping away. And for America, read the NATO European allies. It's amazing how little has been said about this. In the British general election campaign, we've had very big developments in foreign affairs, security issues, which directly or indirectly may well face Britain, and the new government will have to tackle within weeks from where we now speak. You have heard not a smidgen about this any of the discussion.
There was not even a question about it in that debate last week.
Absolutely. And back to your question about China. China senses this. The Gulf and Gulf energy production is very, very important. And it sees it in its own interest to be seen being the good guy here. Watch China and watch Japan.
Jane, final thought on this. As Robert mentioned, Egyptian warships, at least four frigates, I think, have been sent. They've already been reported by some Egyptian media to have shelled Houthi columns from the water. US military aid, possibly coincidentally, possibly not, was restored to Egypt last week. Where is al-Sisi going with this?
He's making a big show of force. A lot of his backing comes from the fact that he is a military man. But at the same time, Egypt fought before in Yemen's civil war in the 1960s. It lost by various estimates between 25,000 and 30,000 men at that time. So they do know Yemen's a dangerous place to get stuck into. They want to show themselves in solidarity with Saudi Arabia. They want to show themselves as an important military power, but they probably don't want to go too far in case they get drawn into a quagmire.
So just ships, not men.
It seems unlikely that they'll want to commit large numbers of ground troops, but if any members of the Arab coalition were to, it would be Egypt. They are the ones with a serious...
The real army, yeah. Yeah. But, interestingly, again, one of the commanders in the new regime has been talking on the record to international media in Saudi Arabia, and I was just amazed to hear this, saying, if it comes to a ground operation, we will consider it. They were saying it on CNN and BBC last week. And the dog that is beginning to bark, if they ball this into the contest, Shia, Sunni, jihadism, and Iran. I think this is a boil which is going to boil throughout throughout the summer.
Well, rather depressingly, yes. I think we will have ample further opportunity to discuss Yemen. We will take a short break for now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Robert Fox and Jane Kinnamont will still be here when we return. Up next, Obama sells his Iran deal, renewed mutterings about women in the ranks, and the CIA bids good riddance to one of its most famous fictional employees.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, at half an hour is now shorter, sweeter, new and improved. Where else can you end up informed and entertained after half an hour? By watching a quarter of Oscar-winning The Theory of Everything, by reading the first 20 pages of Kazuo Ishiguro's new novel, by speed-walking through a thousandth of the Venice Biennale, not on your Nelly. Culture with Robert Bound, smaller and even more perfectly formed.
This is what people do for a living, right? They put their shows on. This is the show of shows.
Culture premieres at 1900 hours London time on Mondays.
Top ingredients, world-class service, less foam and pretension, and honest food made with dedication. Monocle focuses on what we think really matters and launches the Monocle Restaurant Awards. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 to hear of the places we value highly, where we want to dine again and again, and where most restaurant ranking lists may not guide you to.
What does it look like? What is the vitality of this place on the street? And yes, the food has to be outstanding as well, but there are many other elements that go beyond that.
The nominees will be announced every Friday on our food and drink program, The Menu, and the winner will be announced in July. Don't miss out. Tune into The Menu every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me, Robert Fox from London's Evening Standard, Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House. Now, having made the deal with Iran, or at least the deal about the deal, President Barack Obama now has to sell it. To that end, he has granted an audience to the New York Times' inexplicably enduring foreign affairs sage Thomas L. Friedman, a man who never met a metaphor he didn't mix. Obama told him that there is no formula, there is no option to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon that will be more effective than the diplomatic initiative and framework that we put forward, and that's demonstrable. Jane, is he right?
This is a really important point that he's making, actually, that in a way the the deal partly reflects a reluctance on the part of any country to go to war to try to get rid of Iran's nuclear program. And that reluctance includes Israel. Despite the tough talking that we always hear from Netanyahu, his own defence and security establishment seem to have repeatedly taken the view that it's not actually worth trying to act alone and that bombing Iran's nuclear sites could only at best set its program back.
Well, on that front, it struck me, Robert, that the interview did seem to be at least as much about reassuring Israeli opinion as American. Was that the impression you got?
The overall impression, yeah, as you were saying, was how hesitant Obama was. You know, this is the least best, our best bet, and just the answer which they showed on video about Israel goes on and on and on. Well, it's not in our interest. I do realise this could happen or that could happen. It was actually what the famous Democrat fixer, Jesse Unruh, once said about Adlai Stevenson and being a credible candidate for the presidency. You're so goddamn on the one hand and so goddamn on the other. And that was Obama in this thing. He didn't put up a convincing show. I think he's got a problem which he just looked weary of handling. He's got Congress. He's got Israel, as you rightly say, and he's got the hawks in the Saudi Arabia alliance too. And it's a big ask.
It is a huge ask, and you're quite right. But the on the one hand, on the other hand thing, it's I think it's always been a strength of Obama. It's also potentially a weakness. But I was certainly struck by his potted summation of Iranian psychology, in which he made reference explicitly to the United States and the West undermining their democracy, supporting the Shah, supporting Iraq and Saddam during the Iran-Iraq war, and said we have to distinguish between the ideologically driven offensive Iran and the defensive Iran that feels vulnerable and sometimes may be reactive. You can't imagine a Republican president talking like that, can you?
No, absolutely. I remember a few years ago hearing an American Enterprise Institute think tanker say, of course we shouldn't try to understand Iran. It's ridiculous to try to understand your enemies. But of course, diplomacy requires precisely the opposite. It does require understanding their narrative.
Of course, still espoused by John Bolton.
Exactly.
Did you notice in the New York Times, bomb Iran now. Everybody knows that that's completely off. What Obama is spelling out, as Jane quite rightly said, is that I don't think the projection of military power on this one, as things stand, is simply credible. I just don't think it will work. They don't know enough about where everything is. So what, you know, the reasonable man, he's very, very philosophical, as we say, excellent lawyers, advocates approach on the one hand, on the other. And he likes this kind of response from Rouhani and Zarif. The language piece is so important there. And Obama is really saying, look here, world opinion, you're never going to get this combination again of these extremely articulate people, Iranian, absolutely to their fingertips, but they listen to us. And he has got, that Zarif and Rouhani, they have got the support of the Supreme Leader at the moment. Let's keep it this way. And I think what the symptom of the extra mile was how detailed a lot of the framework was. It was there in the Washington Post within the hour of them coming out saying, look, we think we can go with this at Lausanne. And it was much clearer about what could and should happen next than anybody had expected.
I'm not sure if it's a Churchillism or not. It sounds like one, the adage that you don't need to make peace with your friends. I think there is a lot in that. We should move along from that to a story about domestic American military concerns. Later this month, the first female students will begin training at the U.S. Army's Elite Ranger School, and it turns out their presence may not be universally welcomed. A survey of men already serving in U.S. Army Special Forces has revealed widespread doubts that women can meet the physical and mental demands of the work, and related concerns that admission standards might be dropped to help women pass the training. Jane, first of all, shouldn't the only question here be, can they pass the training?
Well, it's not hugely surprising that the men who currently monopolise the jobs don't want new competition. Let's put it that way.
This oppressive mechanism of patriarchy will not maintain itself.
Will not demolish itself voluntarily. But it is something that's untested. There are very few militaries around the world that put women in all the frontline posts. Australia, I think, is embarking on the same thing. Even Israel, which is seen as one of the most gender equal militaries, doesn't put women in the very toughest combat operations. So there aren't many experiences elsewhere to draw from, and there is an amount of uncertainty about that.
Robert, is this the equivalent of concerns about black people or gay people serving in the military, or are there actual genuine military concerns pertaining to human biology here?
I think it's a completely outmoded concept of military efficacy and what is required. I do agree, and they've had difficulties in getting women to meet the standards to become Royal Marine Commandos or join the parachuting. Well, why the hell should they be? In forward intelligence, British girls have been very, very good in Afghanistan and would go in alone to Taliban compounds, and they could do things, honestly, that the men couldn't do. And there's a lot of respect in fighting for INT, intelligence, in the British forces. We seem to have got a bit further than the Americans. This is very much macho kind of stuff. But across the forces at the moment, women are very good pilots. And the things that they want to get involved, excuse me, they don't want to fight on the ground, but they love jobs like... what's it called? Night Stalker. Sorry, it sounds awful. That is driving the helicopters with no lights in darkness. High-risk stuff. They love all that. And the thing is that we do know in complex problem solving, this is when they've been compared, they're often more successful in very difficult circumstances than the men. I think the jury's out on this. And I think, oddly, forces that you've mentioned, like the Australians, Canadians to some extent, and some European forces, are way in advance of America on this.
The bit I have to say that I did need to retrieve my jaw from the desk slightly. The story I read was in Stars and Stripes. I think the survey was by the RAND Corporation, who didn't release specific details, interestingly, but just general trends. The bit that boggled me, and I shouldn't be laughing because it isn't funny, but some expressed worry that women serving in these roles might cause an increase in incidents of sexual harassment or sexual assault, whereas surely you would think the onus is on people not to do that rather than people not to be sexually harassed.
It is a terrifying thing to hear, to be honest, but I guess similarly crass statements are made about gay people in the military as well.
Indeed. So is this, do you think, just a boys' club trying to close ranks then? Is it that simple?
I think you would expect it, that where people are used to one way of doing things and that happens to be a way that benefits them, you know, ultimately this could mean if women were being accepted as equal that they would be competing for the same jobs, expecting the same pay, all these dreadful things. And
you'll be wanting the vote next. It's madness.
No, don't go too far.
What's slightly odd about this, they say, well, in America, they're entering artillery units. They've been in artillery units forever in the UK with female subunit commanders being right up the front line in fire control officers. And I mean, they get in amongst it, and particularly the combat engineers, who are way ahead of any army that might be in the field. I'm sorry, this does seem to be making a military mountain out of a molehill. And honestly, because sources are so constrained, including human resources, that the European forces are not having these problems now. Except for special forces, where you want them to carry these enormously heavy rapid-fire machine guns, which is one of the things that this article showed. I mean, I couldn't carry one of those darn things, so what's the point?
I'm pretty sure I couldn't even lift one up. Finally, on a somewhat related note, the Central Intelligence Agency has taken a public stand on the idea of at least one woman serving in the field. Upon learning that in the next season of the silly but gripping spoke drama Homeland, Claire Danes' character Carrie Matheson will no longer work for the company, the CIA's own actually frequently amusing Twitter feed announced, "Good riddance, Carrie Matheson." Jane, first of all, what do we think in general of the CIA playing it for chuckles on social media? Because it isn't the first time they've done this. Their first tweet last year consisted of the words, "We can neither confirm nor deny that this is the CIA's first tweet." They've since passed comment on denied knowledge of Tupac Shakur's current whereabouts, for example. Should the CIA be making jokes on social media?
Well, apart from being very amusing, it probably probably does it good in terms of giving it a sort of cheerful and less sinister image than it normally has.
It's probably what they want us to think. Robert, this tweet sort of inviting Carrie Mathison not to let the front door at Langley hit her on the way out did spark a quite interesting column by Maureen Dowd in the New York Times, talking to current and former female CIA operatives at the invitation, we should note, of the CIA. Are female CIA operatives right to be happy about the departure of Carrie Mathison as a televisual representative of their kind?
I know people in similar spheres. They do get very, very fed up with the representation of intelligence and intelligence operatives. Liza Manningham Buller, no slow wit herself. The trouble is, when you had the British series Spooks about her agency, MI5, is that she said, the trouble is, every international jihadi plot could be resolved by two men, a woman, and the office dog. And it is oversimplified. Look, the Maureen Dowd piece, I'm a great fan of hers, is one of her very, very best. And she finds some marvellous... She speaks anonymously to some actual serving, but recently retired, of amazing service. And one described when she was in Labour briefing Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, about something. And there were two of them, and it was something really serious. And they were suffering desperately from morning sickness. They threw up in the bathroom, went out and briefed a whole slew of four-star generals. I mean, they're very brave and gutsy ladies. The problem is that they have had a bad press. Think Valerie Plame.
Indeed,
so. And so on. So if they get kick butt on Twitter, good for them.
Jane, on that note, I remember a few years ago interviewing Dame Stella Rimington, who was she MI6 or MI5? MI5, I think. And I did ask her about fictional depictions of the work, because she'd just written a novel. Mm. And she did say the trouble that everybody runs up against is a lot of what we do is incredibly tedious. It would not make for exciting television. Is that just the problem?
I absolutely believe that, and I think the rise of social media has probably massively aggravated it, because now you have many, many people just sitting in huge offices in Virginia, reading Twitter, watching YouTube, looking for mentions of Islamic State, etc. I mean, a lot of it is very dull. Not that many CIA analysts are actually able to travel even to the regions that they analyse. A lot of the time, you are just behind the desk.
Robert, do you have any particular favourite fictional or semi-fictional representatives of intelligence work, or at least any that intelligence people think is more or less on the money?
George Smiley. Mm-hmm. Particularly when Alec Guinness played him. I knew Alec Guinness, but I know David Cornwall, who does know that world inside out. He was completely unique, both George Smiley and Morris Oldfield, on whom he was based. But these people do exist, these people with brains the size of a planet that can do the Times crossword before you can say knife, and, you know, got a double first in classics, and yet know what's going on in the amusement arcade somewhere down in Stratford and Bow. These people do exist, and very amusing they are too. The thing that really sticks in my craw, if I'm allowed this way, one of the films, I really hated a film so much, was Zero Dark Thirty. It was humourless, it was violent, and it was a distortion of great work, whatever you think about it, great work done by many, many anonymous people who were given absolutely no credit. But the dippy redhead, being a genuine redhead myself, the dippy redhead could beat up Osama bin Laden. It's just such drivel.
Jane, do you have a favourite fictional spook, or at least a plausible fictional spook?
I think the favourite and the plausible are probably quite far apart. I am a big fan of John le Carré,
yeah,
and his recent move into sort of the darker side of the war on terror in several of his books, I think, has worked incredibly
He's
well.
He's absolutely
really
obsessed
fascinating.
With it, by the way. He won't give up. Well, is he 82 or 83 is an example to us all. I think there are some terrific characters. I mean, I know it was in Policing, but Gillian Anderson in The Fall. There are some very, very powerful characters in this world now being portrayed by absolutely first-rate actors and actresses.
And on that note, we will have to leave it there. Robert Fox and Jane Kinnamont, thank you both very much for joining us here at Midori House. That's all we have time for. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mikey Wynn. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. For the next half hour, Daniel is still here, keeping you company with Monocle's international playlist. At 1900 hours, Robert Bound is in the chair with Culture. At 2200, the Monocle Daily. This show is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.